We have personal experience of a gambling addiction. I had a member of the family who went for treatment as well, not very old, but had to get treatment for a gambling addiction. It was a shock to the whole family because it's not something you expect to come to your doorstep. You hear about it everywhere else, but when it comes home, you realise the impact that it has and you realise what needs to be done to make a change and to make the change in that person's behaviour. And we went for the sessions up in the White Oaks Addiction Centre. I'm sure many people listening here today will have had the same experience of going to White Oaks, a fabulous facility up there on our doorstep. It does a lot of good, does a lot of good under the radar, because a lot of people don't suppose know the numbers that go through there, or indeed the kind of treatment which was available. But we did, we went through the whole programme up there, helping, say, a member of the family get over their particular addiction. And it was an eye-opening experience, Mark, it has to be said.
What did that person tell you, and I mean about the difficulties? Because it's not chemical in the sense of drugs or booze, or is it?
Well, I think it's more to do with your behaviour, and it's the high that they get from gambling, and to be able to have something running, if you like, and the possibility of winning some money. So it becomes like a crutch in their life, and it dictates their life, so to speak. So, and all of a sudden their life evolves around it, and they will go to any lengths to maintain that particular habit and to feed that addiction. It includes telling lies, mapping out their life in a certain way that they can always get their bet on and get gambling, so that they have that running, if you like, and that rush of adrenaline to think that there's something out there now which is carrying my money. Hopefully it's going to win, and hopefully I will get a high from it.
Do you think people make these choices in life, or do you think, for example, families can be susceptible?
Well, I, to be honest, think that we have an addictive gene in our family, because I felt myself going down that same road, because I sat up in the family session in the White Oak Centre, and I listened to all the stories, because you do that, you sit around in a group setting and everybody describes the impact the person's behaviour is having on the wider family circle. Mm-hmm. And I was sitting there and I was sort of listening, and in my head I was ticking off all the boxes which I was doing in my life, not just the relative of mine who was sitting beside me. And I was thinking, well, this is all sounding very familiar to me. And it was then that I sort of realised, in the weeks after that, whenever I sort of followed through in that pattern and sort of was telling lies at home, you know, it was covering up things, covering my tracks, so that I was gambling, not in a big way. And I'm sure there'll be people out there listening and up the stairs will say, well, you were only a £2 man or a £5 man at most, you know. But it's the fact that you're doing it, and it becomes a habit, if you like.
Does a light go on when you're sitting in the White House and you're going, I'm sitting here with my family, what has gone wrong here? Does something happen when you're in the cold light of day, sitting in the chair waiting to be spoken to by a counsellor or a listener?
Well, in White Oaks, it does for sure, because you can see in the person the reaction when they're sitting there and their family members are sitting beside them. And right. What they do is they spell out in great detail how their behaviour is affecting everybody else in the family. It's sort of a ripple effect, if you like, Mark. They drop the stone in the water, but the ripples continue all the way out along the family line. And that's what has the devastating consequences for people.
John Heaney tells me online, it is so horrendous, it affects so many different aspects of your life. Niall says it's the hidden addiction. There are no outward signs of substance abuse. Very dangerous when it's online, when it's hidden in the family home. And I just outlined finally your plans for next week.
Well, next week, Mark, beginning on Monday from 7 to 9, the breakfast programme runs. We're going to be running a series of interviews with people who have been coping with gambling addiction, and not just them, but also their families. We're going to be hearing from the mothers out there and the wives, and indeed the sisters and brothers who are coping with this as well, and how it is impacting in their families. But more importantly, what help is out there for people? 11 minutes past 7 o'clock. Now, imagine having a bet of £216,000 on a horse and losing. Well, this week we are going to hear from a man who did just that and who's now serving a sentence in McGilligan Prison. He is paying the price for being a compulsive gambler who stole to feed his habit. For much of this week, we on Breakfast are going to be focusing on gambling addiction and the impact it's having on families here in the Northwest.
Every morning we'll hear the personal stories of those men and women who are battling the addiction, some of whom have paid a very heavy price. Some have become alienated from their families, while others have ended up in jail. But it's not only the addicts we'll be hearing from, we've also been talking to their families on what it's like living with a compulsive gambler. And sadly, some have even had to watch as their partners ended up taking their own lives because of the problems brought about by addiction.
But it is important to say we will also be hearing this week from those who have managed to turn their lives around, like this man who started gambling at the age of 8. Here's a sense of how gambling controlled his life.
Even when the family was young growing up, you know, I was very rarely in the house. I'm not saying I wasn't a boogies every day, because I worked nearly all my life. But my priorities was all wrong. You know, my family really didn't count when I was gambling. Nobody counted when I was gambling. And I felt very, very alone, even in a crowd of people. I was the loneliest person there. And I found that sometimes when I won money, it was worse than when I was skimped. Because the lies had to get greater and the stories. And, you know, it was just like a Walter Mitty. Telling stories and scams and plans and schemes. And my head was sort of gambling, even when I was sleeping at night. I very rarely sleep. But when I was sleeping at night, you know, I was dreaming about gambling and I was working out what I was going to do the next day and where was I going to get money and who was I going to rob or whatever, you know.
My gambling had got really bad over a period of about 2 or 3 years, and it resulted in me attempting suicide and also going to jail. I had a period in my life where there was a few problems. I couldn't cope with them and gambling was my coping mechanism. Online was the main one. It's just onto the laptop, onto a site, and that was me in a bubble. People didn't know I was gambling, but they knew there was something wrong with me. I went from being somebody that would be naturally sociable. You know, I would have talked to the devil. You know, it would have been described sort of as nice girl, pleasant girl, always smiling. And I went from that to hermit mode. It just stripped away, you know, my personality, stripped away the respect that I had for myself. The deeper that I get into it and to find not so nice ways of, you know, getting money.
When you say not so nice ways of getting money, what do you mean?
I was an accountant and I had worked for the same employer from I was a teenager for 13 years. When I got really bad, I was blowing through my wages and I was on, you know, I was on a good wage. Unfortunately then I had access to checks in work. So what I was doing was using those then to cover, you know, the normal expenditure of life to keep up the pretense that, you know, everything was okay. When I realised that it was coming out through work, my main concern was that my mum didn't find out. And I had madness. I remember in the middle of the night emailing a solicitor to say all I knew was that, you know, there had been suspicion and that the police were involved. I remember emailing a solicitor about 3 a.m. saying, look, can I just hand myself in? I just can't have the police turn up at my mum's door. I decided then that the best way would be to commit suicide, but to make it look like an accident. And then nobody would need to know. You know, that I had become a thief and a liar, and my mum and stepdad found me the next morning and had to take me to the hospital. And that's when it all came out. And that was the first my mum, my family, my friends knew anything about it. And then got out, that was Sunday night. Monday night I got out of hospital, and on the Tuesday, obviously we had no idea when the police were coming, but the police arrived at the door to raid the house. So in the space of 48 hours, you know, my mum and my family had all of that to deal with.
What did your mum say?
She was actually amazing. My whole family and friends, you know, have been amazing the whole way through. She was just like, it's happened, we have to deal with it, you know.
Do you feel guilty about the money that was taken from people?
Very much so. Prison helped that way in a bit, you know, it relieved the guilt slightly because I got punished for it. But it's more the trust that I broke with people.
Can you describe the moment, sort of the first night or the first time you walk into a prison? What is that even like?
That moment when the door closes and you're in a room, you realise that you're completely on your own and there's, you know, you can't get out.
You must have had a moment of, how did I get here?
Mm. When I got sentenced, and I remember looking around to see my mum and, sorry, my sister and that, and just seeing the complete heartbreak on their faces, that was hard.
I started going to meetings, and I went to meetings in Buncrana. I went to meetings in Derry. I went to meetings in Letterkenny. And I went to meetings in many other parts. But I know for me, the key to recovery, the key to bringing hope, love and warmth to a family situation is by going to meetings on a regular basis. Mm-hmm. And I know myself today that if I had cancer, there's nothing I wouldn't do. And I know there's nothing that people wouldn't do for me. And it's exactly the same. Going to the meetings is exactly the same. I have a disease of compulsive gambling. Mm-hmm. There's nothing when I'm in action I won't do in order to have money in order to engage in that addiction.
What exactly happens at the meetings, Patrick, for those people out there who've never been to a Gamblers Anonymous meeting?
Well, you come into a meeting and you meet like-minded people like yourself, and they share their experience, their difficulties, their pain, their anguish, the frustration, the harm they cause to their family. And that's it, basically. And then you know, as you go on, you get people who kind of stopped all that by coming to meetings. Mm-hmm. And you can get a glimpse of what life can be like without gambling.
And you can
be a responsible person. Mm-hmm.
And can you ever stop the meetings? Can you ever say, I don't think I need to go any more meetings?
No, I would never, ever, ever take a chance. Life is too good for me. Life can never be any better than it is for me today. But when I went into Gamblers Anonymous, I had cardboard in my shoes. I inflicted awful pain on my wife and children. I left them in despair, emptiness, left them without the basic necessities of food. The bank wanted to come and repossess our house. We had a brand new car, and this is the outward sign of it, and we had to sell it. Imagine walking up the street in your neighbourhood having a new car, and sometime later having no car.
Well, all this week on Breakfast, we have been focusing on problem gambling. This morning, I'm in a White Oaks Rehabilitation Centre on the outskirts of Derry, where people battling the addiction very often turn to for help. They also, by the way, can get support through Gamblers Anonymous, very active organisation within the Northwest. For those, Elaine, who don't know what White Oaks is like, it is a very tranquil place here, just on the outskirts of the city, just near Muff there. Very quiet here this morning, as you would expect, because it is pretty early in the morning, but tranquil too when you consider the turmoil that is very often going on behind these doors here. For those people getting treatment, it is very relaxed, and it is a good place, I would imagine, to take time out of your life and to take stock and to reflect on where your life is headed. We're going to be getting a tour, in fact, during the course of the programme this morning between now and 9 o'clock. Our own Teresa Craig is with us this morning, and she's going to be getting into some of those rooms where all the hard work here takes place.
It'll be great to get that kind of behind the doors look at it, because I'm sure a lot of people will wonder what it's like. All this weekend as well, we've heard so many personal stories. We've been pretty overwhelmed, I suppose, by the bravery of people coming forward, and our listeners have been really struck by them as well, haven't they?
Exactly, Elaine. I think we all have been struck in radio foil by the stories that we have heard so far this week from the various gambling addicts who were brave enough to bare their soul and to start talking about when their problems started and how it devastated many of their lives, and how they were then able to turn things around with the help of White Oaks and indeed Gamblers Anonymous. For instance, we heard from the man who started gambling at the age of 8, mm-hmm. and then he went on to feed his habit while working in a bookie shop. And then there was the lady, of course, Elaine, you talked to. We heard from her yesterday, who went from being a successful accountant to becoming a thief and ending up in prison, didn't she?
Yeah, and what struck me about Lisa was that she was just, her life before was so normal. This was a secret she kept from everyone, and it was only when that secret started to unravel that people actually found out. And in the space of 3 days, as she told us, you know, she tried to commit suicide. Everyone found out what was going on behind the scenes, and the police raided her house, and ultimately she went to prison, which was extraordinary. And as she said, she never had even a bad school report before that, you know, when she finds herself in prison for 6 months. But what we heard from Lisa was sort of, there's kind of a common thread, hasn't there, Enda, between the stories we've heard this week. That's what struck me.
Yes, there's most definitely a pattern as to, the, I suppose, the lies and the deceit, first of all, whenever people lead double lives, whenever they are gambling, to the point at which it all comes crashing down around them, whenever their loved ones discover what they have been doing. And then there's a point then where they all sort of reach out for help, mm-hmm. and that the various organisations then step in to try and help them. And we're going to be hearing more stories like that, in fact, today, Elaine. We're going to be hearing, for instance, from a man just after 7:30, a man called Brian, who's from Donegal, who came here to White Oaks, managed to get his life back on track, and he is in a much better place now. He's going to be telling us how his life was essentially devastated because of his gambling habit, the lies that he told, the fact that he even contemplated suicide. He stole money, in fact, Elaine, from his son. His son was only 1 year old, wow. but it was all the christening money and the birthday money that he stole to feed his habits. You can imagine the guilt that he is carrying around.
White Oaks is described as a rehabilitation centre, and I suppose that is the purpose. It's to offer people the opportunity to rehabilitate, to be restored, to recover dignity and self-worth, because those very things have been undermined by some form of addiction, whether it be alcohol, drugs, or indeed, as you're focusing on this week, on gambling. When people arrive here, invariably, people come here broken. They come as people who are under great pressure, a sense of desperation. So when they come to White Oaks for 30 days, they begin that process of recovery, which first of all means offering a place which is safe, secure, and at the same time where they can also begin to examine the reality of what has been going on in their lives. Not only how it's been affecting them, but also the impact that it's been having on their family and on people close to them. So we do that in a safe, secure and supportive environment, and that's what the 30 Days programme offers. We see it very much as simply a foundation, mm-hmm. a foundation that they must continue to build on if they're to maintain recovery. Mm-hmm. That's why we have 2 years of aftercare.
Mm-hmm. And it is pretty surreal for me sitting here this morning in your boardroom, so to speak, because just down the corridor from here, there are 10 people here right now, yes. in the centre getting treatment. What will mm-hmm. they be going through right now in their head to try and turn things around for themselves? Just briefly, Steve.
Well, we begin, first of all, by encouraging people to do a little bit of their own background. We look at social history. We look at a chemical history in the case of drugs and alcohol. So we get people to look at the context of their lives, and that enables them to begin the process of opening up.
Yes, lots of people that have got in touch with us or that we've heard from this week have talked about getting help, how it has turned their lives around, taking one day at a time. So if you're listening to us, if you have a gambling addiction and need help, or there's someone in your family that you think needs help, it is there. You can call Gambler Anonymous 71351 329. That's 71351 329. The Samaritans are able to help as well. 0845790909090. We'll be giving out those numbers throughout the programme.
I went down to the town one Christmas to do a bit of shopping, and decided, well, before I do the Christmas shopping, sure, I'll stop on here in the Boogies and, you know, maybe raise that bit of money. And of course, when I went home that evening, I had nothing. And I left my wife and child with no presents and no food on the table for Christmas, which was very embarrassing for her too, because she had to go and ask her sister for money, you know, and that's not nice. And it took me to a very low place at that time, and I had a lot of regret about it, and I thought to myself, you know, I can't live like this, I can't go on like that. You know, I was coming home and I was scared to answer the phone in case maybe the wife was looking for a carton of milk out of the shop and maybe no money. That's how low I was. I seriously considered suicide. I was falling into a bit of a depression, and I was going into a bookies and I wasn't even enjoying it, but I was still going back in.
And how did your wife cope through all of this? Because you must have been telling a lot of lies to cover your tracks.
Well, the lies was the biggest deceit in my whole thing about it. Was she couldn't get her head around everything that was going on. She was having different thoughts, you know. Was it having an affair? Our marriage was practically dead because of what I was doing. And she was living in misery, like, and it's not a nice thing for me, I have to admit. But, you know, I resorted to stealing to feed my addiction. And
Who did you steal from?
My family, my son, You know, my son had money and I stole it. Gambling turned me into a liar and a thief, you know, and a very dishonest person. And it nearly took my life.
And eventually you did go forward for treatment. You went to the White Oaks treatment facility there. What was that like?
I went to White Oaks. I went down for an assessment. When me and her come out about the gambling and all, she says to me, you know, that I needed help. And first, I didn't think I needed help or I didn't want help. And I was very reluctant, you know, but my marriage was on the line, you know. My whole livelihood was on the line. So I made a decision that I would phone White Oaks, and my wife took me down for an assessment, and we done the assessment, and it was agreed that I would come in for treatment and for 30 days. I have to say, when I did eventually go into White Oaks, I worked very hard at it because I really wanted to stop what was happening to me.
And how has your life changed for you now?
My life has changed dramatically. I am happy. I can see my son. I used to, like, we live in a driveway and my son would be standing looking out the window. We have low windows in the house. But when I was gambling, coming in that driveway, I was like a zombie, you know, and he could be sitting waving and I wouldn't even have seen him. Where now, you know, I see everything that goes on. I still don't carry money. And
why not?
Well, you wouldn't ask an alcoholic to carry a bottle of vodka. So you wouldn't, you know. So realistically speaking, like, when you're first gambling, or it's all about the money.
Do you think you will ever bet again?
I hope not. You know, I'm very realistic about this. I know it's an addiction, and addictions have wicked ways of working. Gambling is like any other addiction. It's one day at a time. Mm-hmm. I didn't bet today so far, so that's a good day for me.
2 minutes after the race, the buzz is gone. Like, there's as big a buzz out of the horse running and getting beat as there is out of winning, because that's what you live for. You live for the adrenaline. But 2 days after, it's a complete nightmare. Whenever you've realised, right, I've spent somebody's money that's not mine.
So you were stealing money?
Yes, I was stealing money. Yeah, of course it was.
Who from?
Everyone that was close to me. You know, I've been stealing probably off my family since I was 15 years age, 16 years age to... right up at the end to where I stole off clients and fraudulent claims off HMRC. And it's just mind-boggling for me, even looking back on it, you know, the dirty tricks that you exposed yourself to. Because out of addiction, I'm a decent human being. In addiction, I would have done anything for money. The urge, the want, the need, just to get that bet, you know. It's frightening, it really is, you know. If somebody told me the story where I went to at the end of it and said to me, you'll do that whenever I was 20 years age, I just said, not a chance.
And have you ever been able to put a figure on the amount of money that you stole to feed your habit?
I couldn't even attempt it. That's been honest with you. I couldn't even attempt it. The courts put $167,000 in the first case. They put, I think, $70,000 or $80,000 on the second case. But it's well in excess of that.
Could be talking millions?
Yeah, I would have no doubt there are millions floating about. But saying that, now I was quite successful at what I'd done, so I made good money, and I blew it as well. You know, I mind 1 weekend taking a mortgage for $306,000 and losing the whole thing out in the property. You know, and it only lasted a couple or 3 days. So that's the kind of money you were talking.
And how were you able to cover your tracks? Stealing that amount of money, gambling at that type of rate, and still being able to do it?
Yeah, I suppose whenever you're an accountant and people trust you, even they were getting letters in to say that things wasn't paid, the first person they phoned was me, and I was able to tell them a lie. And until the end of it, where I was caught red-handed, where a client actually came in and reached me a check, a copy of a check, and says, what's going on here? I think it was 4 checks totaling 60 or 80 grand or something in them regions, and they were made out to me rather than HMRC.
How were you able to lie in your bed at night?
You weren't.
Knowing that what you were doing was causing so much misery in so many other lives.
You weren't. That was the big one for me. I would say for 5 years I never slept. I spent it drinking and gambling. And that was just a outward sign of how much turmoil my insides was in, you know. That was the only way I could get peace from it, was actually be gambling. Whenever you were gambling, you didn't have to think about it. And gambling was the way out, which is crazy in hindsight, but it's the only way I could get any peace. you know, it's very, very hard to look at family whenever you're doing things like that. And my way was, I just moved away. I just isolated myself. Even with a wife, like, I ruined a relationship with a wife that I never would have done if I hadn't been gambling.
We're sitting now in your cell and you've had an awful long time to think about what you've done in life. You've already served a year and you have 6 months ahead of you before you get released again. As you lie in your bed here in this cell, do you ever think of those people that you took money from?
Absolutely. I don't think that's anything that'll ever escape my attention, you know, and at some stage I'll get a chance to put it right with them.
Slowly. It was a very slow process, but slowly we got through it and got to where we are today. But as I say, my husband and I both would have a deep faith. His would probably be deeper than mine, but we would... our faith would have brought us through a lot of it.
And from your experience, how big of a problem do you think it is in this city?
Oh, gosh, I think it's a massive problem. I don't think people realise how big a problem it is because, as we say, you can't see it. You can't see it. I didn't see it. You can't see it. You can see people who are drinking. You can see people who are taking drugs. But you can't see people who are gambling. People can gamble their money and they can gamble everybody else's money as well. And they can be very deceitful. They can tell you the greatest story and they can tell you, like, oh, I need money for this and I need money for that. But the money's ultimately for gambling.
Do you think your husband will ever gamble again?
Oh, no. No, no. Thank God. I just say thank God. No, I don't have any worries on that score at all. Thank God.
You're in a better place now?
Oh, definitely. Definitely.
And what's that like?
Great. Great.
You strike me now, though, as a woman who is very proud of her husband.
Oh, yes.
Given what he's come through.
Oh, definitely. And he is he's amazing. He's amazing where he's come from and where he is now. He is amazing, the person. Because I watched him and to me he was destroying himself and destroying the person that I'd fallen in love with. And I couldn't do anything about it. I couldn't stop it. And I couldn't stop him. It had to come from him. Thankfully it did.
It's very hard to speak about because I was so close but so far of helping him. I tried everything, talking to him. I tried to get him help. He was just in denial to the end. And it was obvious that the pressure just got too much for him. The debt was just way over his head, completely over his head. He just spent more money and more money as the weeks went on. But I just feel sad and upset that he couldn't tell his own wife what he was going through.
You have a 19-year-old son as well.
Well, believe it or not, I only told my son about it last week or so, because I've only sort of come to terms with it myself and trying to get my head around it. And I thought many a night, would they tell my son, you know, that his father had that problem? I was scared to tell my son in case maybe he ended up the same way. You know, I'm scared in case the son takes after the father, and it was just hard. But I eventually told him. My husband left him a letter, you see. I opened it and read it, but I never told my son that it was here until last week. But it's hard, you know, because I miss my husband, you know, but I'm still quite angry, you know, the way everything's left. And I'm... sorry, excuse me.
And you have the letter here now, and you want to raise awareness here. You want to let people know how serious of an issue this is. How much debt was your husband actually in?
All in all, my husband left me debt of £22,000. And I have the wee letter here that I read to my son. Darling, I know I broke your heart, but I was in a bad place. I'm sorry. And I know you'll keep our boy on the straight path. God, that's all. That's what I have left out of this mess and no husband.